What's up, guys? My name is Phil DeRue. I'm the head strength and conditioning coach at American Top Team, and I want to invite you guys to my two-city seminar tour in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia. I'll be in Melbourne July 28th through the 29th with presentations on combat sports physical preparation and program design. I also will be holding consultations all week long in Melbourne over at the Strong Room. Then I'll be headed over to Sydney, Australia, August 4th through the 5th, where I'll also be presenting on programming and doing a full workshop that Sunday. So don't miss out on this opportunity. Hit my boy Mac up to get full details on how you can sign up, and I'll see you there.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to the Unknown Strength Podcast. I am your host, McGregor McNair. My co-host, Brenton, will not be joining us today. I'll be flying solo. Brenton is commentating for BOA Super 8, the Submission Grappling Tournament, which is happening today. So he's tied up with those guys doing running around, whatever they're getting up to in the lead up to the event this afternoon and this evening. So I'm flying solo and you guys are stuck with me. So deal with it. On our show today, episode 20, we have a very special guest, Mr. Tony Ricci. I'll get into more about who Tony is in a little while. But first of all, the Phil DeRue Daru Strong Seminar Tour in Australia. It's happening. We're bringing Phil out. He's doing a Melbourne seminar and a Sydney seminar, and both of them are going to be absolutely phenomenal. Very unique experience planned for the Melbourne event in particular. We'll be holding a workshop educational seminar on the Saturday, which is Saturday the 28th of July, and on the Sunday the 29th, UFC on Fox 30 is happening live. So we'll be watching that. We'll be streaming the event live at the Strong Room and watching Phil watch his fighters. We'll be watching with Phil because three of his best fighters are competing on that card, including Dustin Poirier, Tisha Torres, and Joanna Jędrzejczyk. So those two girls, Tisha and Joanna, are fighting each other. It's going to be a cracker of a fight. And an incredible opportunity to get inside Phil's head and discuss what went on in the camps for all these guys and really just kind of get to know how Phil does things at another level. So be excited for that. The Sydney date, the Saturday the 4th of August and Sunday the 5th of August, you get two full days of workshop, seminar, education. So on day one, Phil's going to be covering sports and nutrition for combat sports, including training supplementation, weight cutting, nutrient breakdown, the benefits of sodium, refuel and rehydration post weigh-ins, and a Q&A session. And on the Sunday, Phil will be doing centering the workshop around the training and periodization. So you've got program design for fighters' performance, periodization for each individual circumstance, understanding the bioenergetic demands of the sport, assessment protocols, special exercises, the art of coaching fighters, power development for fighters, functional range conditioning cars, dynamic warm-up, and form breakdown for Phil's three top strength lifts for fighters. So as you can see, jam-packed for both days. The Saturday and the Sunday, 4th and 5th of August in Sydney at Lift Performance Centre. Tickets are $900 Australian dollars because the early bird tickets are all sold out. So get in quick, secure your ticket, $900 for the Sydney show. The Melbourne event, the Melbourne show, is $500 for the Saturday only and $600 for both Saturday and Sunday. So if you want to jump on and grab tickets for that now, please do go to Facebook, search for the events. All you need to do is search in Facebook for Daru Strong Melbourne or Daru Strong Sydney and buy your tickets there. Now, we need to thank our sponsors also. Firstly, MMA Fight Store have been terrific. They've been really looking after us over here at the podcast. Their website is www.mmafightstore.com.au. These guys have got the best range of combat sports equipment online and in store. So head on down to any one of their stores, mention the Unknown Strength podcast, and get a 10% discount. We also need to thank Melbourne band Killed by Technology for our intro song. Unsociable Behaviour is the name of it. That's their latest single. So check them out. These guys are awesome. Check them out on Facebook, Instagram, SoundCloud. Killed by Technology. And our latest sponsor, Gripedo. That's www.gripedo.com, G-R-I-P-E-D-O.com. The Gripedo is a grip training device. It's a tool for training your grip, especially for grapplers and fighters. It has a whole bunch of uses. Now, I've been talking about reviewing this product for some time now, and the review is in the works. There have been a few things that have been preventing me from sharing the review with you, but Emery, my man over at Gripedo, has been very patient with me and very understanding. So please, everybody, stay tuned. I know you're sick of hearing about it, but the review is coming. Okay, also we need to say thank you to our main man, James Tomlinson, JT Tenacity, over at JuGo. That's www.jiu-go.com. JuGo is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu-based card game whereby you move through a series or a sequence of positions, transitions, and submissions to obviously finally submit your opponent. So it's a really good way to introduce people to just some of the concepts of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and it's a lot of fun along the way. So check them out. Now, our guest today, Mr. Tony Ricci. What a epic interview that was. Not so much in the length of the interview, but in the depth we got into in some of these topics. A fascinating man. He's been around the sport for so long now. Over 25 years, Tony Ricci has been working with fighters at the top levels of the sport. We're talking about boxing, kickboxing, wrestling, judo, Muay Thai, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and of course MMA. So he's done it all, he's seen it all. But I guess most importantly is some of his academic achievements in the fields of sports science and nutritional biochemistry. He's the assistant professor of sports science and nutritional biochemistry at the Long Island University. He did his original doctoral research in nutrition and neuroenergetics. And at 51 years of age, he took on his second doctorate, which he's currently doing, which is sports psychology and neurocognition. Fascinating topics for anyone involved in performance coaching. So he's also got master's degrees in both sports science and nutrition. And as I said, he's been working with fighters for that long now, and he's educated to such a level that this man, he is just a treasure trove of knowledge and experience in strength and conditioning and performance coaching for fighters. So I hope you guys get a whole lot out of this interview. I know I certainly did. You can probably hear me geeking out throughout the interview, but I hope you guys all enjoy it as much as I did. Cheers. Okay, thank you so much for joining us, Professor Tony Ricci. What a privilege and an honor to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us, my man.
Hey, thank you for having me, Matt. Great to connect with you guys in Australia. It's wonderful.
For sure, man. Now, look, we've finally done it. We've completed the Four Horsemen of the Fight Science Institute. We've been talking about doing it for a few months now. But as you know, we've had Phil DeRue, we've had Dr. Corey Peacock, we've had Chris Algieri, and now we have yourself. And I can't tell you how excited I am to have you on today, man.
Yeah, and thank you for taking on the team. Those are some great guys and good minds, great athletes, and been in the game a long time. So that's why we all kind of got together, Mac, to put a little project together. And I'm glad you had the opportunity to speak with them.
Yeah, we were very fortunate, man. It all came together really, really nicely. And, you know, one of the things you just touched on about the Fight Science Institute is on your Instagram, on the Instagram page, there's something like it's detailing the amount of years, the amount of degrees, the amount of qualifications, and the amount of world championship fighters and camps that you four guys have worked with over your collective careers, and it's really, really quite astounding the amount of stuff you four guys have actually done.
Yeah, and you know, it's not even there, I think, Mac. Like, we don't want to present it as anything for bragging. It's more there to show how in love with this we are, I believe. To demonstrate that, hey, this is what we eat, sleep, and drink. And train, fight physiology, if you will, keeps us up at night. And we don't have all the answers, but we have some really good questions. And when we aggregate all that information together, Corey's background, Phil, Chris Algieri, it's for that purpose. It's to show people that we want them to join us. We want them to come along and ask questions and give us information and learn from them, because we really love what we're doing. And it's really to demonstrate that it's a time commitment, that this is matters to us. And we want to get some good information out there. We want to pull some good information in. And that's really FSI's intent, is to get the best information available, the best questions that can be asked, and how to answer them when it comes to enhancing fight performance. That's really our goal.
For sure. So that's the end game. The overall mission of the Fight Science Institute is to propagate all of that information, start asking more questions, which lead to even more questions, and keep eating, sleeping, and breathing this stuff. I love it.
Yep. That's where we're going with it. So, you know, there's a lot of, let's put it this way. I always say that to my students, Mac. The answers change. The questions remain the same, right? What's good to eat? Every day it's something new. What's a good training protocol? Every day it's something new. But those questions are a constant, and the answers evolve. So, you know, we're going to try to make sure we're asking the right thing and coming to some rational conclusions about how to approach things.
And I suppose science and technology kind of, over the decades, kind of catches up with those questions a little bit, and maybe even redirects those questions in a different way. Do you find that?
Absolutely, and I think you stated it perfectly. The technology, if you will, both Dr. Peacock and I have lab access, and I just got back from the UFCPI Coaches Summit, and that, of course, is a wonderful facility with some amazing people. I don't have enough good to say about those guys and ladies there. I think they're doing a nice work. That's those in the facility. But you stated it perfectly. The purpose of sports science and technology is to potentially measure things that maybe we couldn't quite get a grasp of before. It is not to completely change the sport. Nobody's turning the game on its head, but it's to redirect things, to get insight into fight physiology or that of a particular fighter throughout the course of their career, throughout the course of their off season, if you will, throughout the course of their camp, and aggregate that information and see if we can just fine tune and improve what they're doing. I like the way you phrased it, the toys, the instruments, the tools we use to measure performance, whatever that would be, a force plate, a heart rate monitor. They are to help redirect it if needed. And that's perfectly stated, giving us insight to things that we can only rationally guess about or rationally come to a prediction of how to do something previously. Now it helps us refine it. Instead of there being three forks in a road, at least we've narrowed it down to two, if you will, you know?
Yeah. And then a couple decades later, it's narrowed down to one.
Yeah, we'll see.
There's so many things I want to unpack in that last little bit. You touched on the Fight Science Institute. You touched on the UFC Performance Institute. Why don't we kick off with the Performance Institute, because there was the annual coaches. Was it the summit? The annual coaches summit?
Yeah, they called it. Yep, was kind of an inaugural summit meeting in which they invited some skill coaches and performance coaches. Forrest Griffin kind of set that up with collaboration with some other coaches, and he invited them in, both skill and performance. And essentially what they did is sat down and say, hey, you know, here's what we did the first year. And here's why I feel from my heart that Forrest, Dr. Duncan French, Bo Sandoval, physical therapist Dr. Heather Linden, Roman Froman's over there. They got some really good people. You know, what happened, really, Mac, is they essentially were handed a $30 million facility, and that was it. Now, you might say, well, I wish I had that problem. But no one told them anything. It wasn't like, here's what we want from you. So they literally had a first creative vision. What are we going to do with this place? Like, why is it here? And so essentially they had this wonderful facility with a bunch of skill coaches and fighters who were never really going to come in unless they were fighting or unless they lived in Las Vegas. So the first thing they had to do was start outreach. And then, you know, secondly, what was the data that they would aggregate while they were there? So a fighter comes in, hey, what are we going to put them through? Then secondarily, they had to establish, well, while we're here, what do we do? How do we measure fight performance? What is important? What data should we measure? What should we aggregate? How do we establish norms? They came away with doing some of that. Then they had to choose, all right, we know what we want. We want to have a fighter come in, do a full assessment, have information on them, prognosticate how they can make weight, where they stand in their weight class on those norms. But how are we going to test them? What are the best testing protocols? They had to decide that. They did such with that, and then they started aggregating the data. And they put out a book and a cross-sectional analysis of the UFC fighter. And one can critique it, and one can say, well, you know, the statistical analysis of A, B, and C is not perfect, or they don't have a large enough cross-section. That's not relevant to me, Mac. What is relevant is, I think, again, they are directing the future of what we need to ask, what we need to look at. So what is important in fight physiology? You know, what is important to measure? Should we measure force plate production, reactive strength index? Should we measure, you know, the vertical jump? And these are the questions they ask to establish norms, and at least they give us some good direction. So I think they've got really from the heart, I think they've all come out and done a really good job. And they're disseminating that information. Just a couple of things to close on that. You know, everybody was worried that the UFCPI was going to have the attitude, hey, you want this done, you come here. No, they want to bring the fighters in, and then they are reaching out to the strength coaches, the skill coaches, the performance coaches worldwide, saying, here's the data, here's what we see, what do you see, and how can we help that fighter together? And I commend them for that. I think they're genuinely doing a great job.
Okay, so that's excellent. I've got a couple of really, really specific questions there. What do you see are the areas where this kind of authority in the industry may be perverted, for want of a better word?
So in better words, you know, having this much, having the center and misuse, is that more what we're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm trying to get at. Can this be corrupted or misused?
You know, yeah, that's a great question, because for 13 years, I was the senior nutritionist at Pfizer. It's a pharmaceutical company. My primary job, though, there was when I was there, Mac, was to advertise and promote our internal wellness programs and get people to participate. And the fear was, in order for them to do that, they would be giving up health information. So obviously, what did we have to do? Oh, well, what are you using this information for? To raise my insurance rates and fire me? Like, that's the thinking that people had. In a large sense, the UFCPI has to sell the skill coaches and the fighters the same way, and the performance coaches. No one sees the data. In a personal sense, it's just aggregated. So Dana White, Silva, you know, these guys, the matchmakers, they don't get access to personal data. A lot of the skill coaches there were questioning, hey, well, if I bring my fighter in and my fighter's scheduled for a big fight and you get, you know, data on them that demonstrates they're not entirely healthy or ill-prepared for to make the weight, as an example, am I going to lose that match? The answer to that is no, because all of the data remains nameless except to the fighter and whom the fighter gives permission to. So I guess my point to that would be, if that data were to leak, personal data, and it were to be part of matchmaking, either promoting somebody because of it or discarding somebody, then that would be the issue that I would see, or the potential problem. Outside of that, I don't, with the crew that's running it now, I don't foresee any way that that information would be perverted, except for individualizing it. Makes sense? Saying, well, John Smith. Well, you thought Joe Smith. Jones is a popular name. I didn't even mean to use him. John Smith is a fighter. And John Smith, here is John Smith's data. Oh, wow. He's going to never make weight. He has a knee injury. None of that is going to the matchmakers. And that's the only potential issue that would propose a problem in my eyes. But as you know better than I, hey, humans are good at causing problems and messing things up. So maybe there are things that are yet unforeseen, but I have all the trust in the world with the current crew that is in there, because I honestly think they're doing good work.
Fantastic. And I mean, being gifted with such an incredible facility, as you say, like a $30 million facility, I guess these guys are all like kids in a candy store. You know, they don't want to mess up this opportunity. There's so many possibilities that these guys can create with such a facility. One of the things I was kind of leading at there was perhaps commercial interests getting their hands on some of this information. You know, some companies may put their products or whatever in front of certain people as a result of getting their hands on this information. Do you see that as a potential threat?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful concern. If there's such a thing as something that is a potential problem being wonderful, I think it's a sharp way to think. I don't foresee that because, to reiterate, it's not, you know, somebody's going to have to break into the database or the fighter's going to have to run around once they receive their information, sharing it with the world. But that's the fighter's choice, right? So they've already put forth, for some of my guys have gone out there, and I can do everything that they're doing in the lab out here. But hey, they like to go out there, and they should. So they'll have, you know, DEXA scan. They'll do VO2 testing, a reactive strength indexes, you know, all these types of things. And the fighter will receive that information. And they'll get a standing as to where they are to the best of the ability when compared to other people in their weight class regarding those metrics. The only way that can really become an issue, I would think, is the fighter would have to self-promote that information. And half the time, they're on Instagram showing what they're taking, the rehab they're doing, the way they're training anyway. So, you know, the UFC is not going to go give that information, UFCPI, to John's nutrition company and say, this guy is not making weight, and I know you have a weight cut product. That's not going to happen. I feel very confident, unless there was some kind of breach or break-in. And that's just, you know, but that can happen to any company.
Okay. So that alleviates some of my concerns there, because it's a...
And they're fair concerns. They're fair.
Yeah, it's such a new thing, and it's such an exciting thing. I just hope everyone's thought it through.
Yeah, well, you know what? They're thinking it through. They really are. And you can tell, and just to reiterate, the questions that were given to them and proposed to them show the same concerns that you do right now. And you know what? Dr. French, Forrest, Bo, Heather Linden, Dr. Linden, physical therapist, they agree. They understand the concerns. They're not running from the concerns. They're telling you, here's what we know that people may be wary of, but here's what we do. So again, it's good outreach. That's the nice thing about it, Mac. This is not a clandestine operation. This is, here's everything we did in a year. Here's how we do it. We don't know everything. We want to improve it. We want your feedback. Help us get better. And I appreciate that. That could be theater from the UFC higher ups, but I don't think it's theater from the team. I think they genuinely mean it.
Okay, that's great. Now, back to the summit itself, what were some of these actual takeaways? Some of the things you mentioned, you were discussing, what are the best things to measure, you know, the markers for fighters' performance? You know, what were some of those specifics that you guys were discussing?
Well, a lot of the original information that was provided was a lot of fight metric, right? So Dr. Duncan would say this, what are we owed to you first? And that is, how are fights won? How do you win in this game? What is the job of a strength and conditioning coach or a team at Ohio State University in the United States for American football? The job is, you have to take care of your athletes, but the job is also to learn how to win. So the initial information is a lot of fight metric data. For example, watching the course over the last 14 years of a fight go in about 2004, to about 7:04 in duration, 7 minutes. So around one round in, 2 minutes, up to 10:32. Now we have a longer average in the fights. So what does that teach us? Well, that teaches us, hey, as a conditioning coaches, that's something we need to be cognizant of. That even if you are a very powerful knockout artist, like Vitor was in the early days, if you don't score that way, you're in for a 10-minute fight. So we better be prepared for something longer if somebody can take you down or they can be evasive in that punching. So right there, that's helpful information in my eyes. Secondarily, they're telling you how are these fights won, all right? 77% or in that range are strike initiated right now. In the earlier days, they were more submission-based, but now they're strike initiated. Now, that does not mean you may win the fight on the strike, but that strike might have knocked that person to the ground and initiated the finish or the submission, as an example. So the first thing they're doing is showing you, here's the information. Here's the information by weight class. Here's the information how the women's straw weights are performing. And are they stand up? Are they winning by submission? Rear naked chokes. So you get that data aggregated into one pool. And if you're a skill coach, I find it helpful. Sure, you could go on Fight Metric, but then you got to sit there and put it all together yourself. Now it's all in front of you. So the primary goal in their message is, hey, we got to tell you how fights are won. Isn't that your job? Your job is to make exciting fighters, UFC fighters, and that bring on a good show, but yet that, you know, are going to be healthy, and how to win the fight. So that information, of course, is just Fight Metric data, but aggregated in one place, it's really helpful. Secondarily, they also look at the injury data, and they provide you with training. What's the number one injury occurs in training? How long does that keep the athlete out? What's the number one injury in the fights? How long is the athlete kept out? So, of course, if there are any preventative measures that one can take in conditioning protocols for injury prevention, such as ACL as an example, or neck prevention, the prevention of neck injuries, you do that. You put that into the program knowing, okay, well, here's the number one injury, and here's the time at which we're being kept out of that. And then secondarily, there's some basic there's some basic exercise physiology metrics and markers. They're doing the DEXA scan. So we have the percentage of body fat, lean mass, which of course is the mathematical requirements to know if somebody's going to make weight and how they're going to make it. VO2. People will argue that the VO2 does not have any relationship to the fight. That may be fair, okay? However, it tells you what type of athlete you're dealing with. Are they conditioned? Are they deconditioned? Are they an endurance athlete? Are they a power athlete? Reactive strength indexes, bilateral symmetry and strength. They can measure that on force plates. Your left leg is weaker than the right leg. You're putting out less power in the lower extremities than all the other middleweights at 185 pounds. Wingate testing, your anaerobic capacity. Why is that important? Because it's been demonstrated through the data that the fights are still won in an 8 to 14 second window. 76% of the fights occur in a burst, if you will, an ATP, PCR, glycolytic burst. In better words, within that 14-second window, it's multiple strikes, punching, knees, and then you have a 2 or 3 to 1 interval in which that period calms down again. So these are just some of the data that are being afforded to us, and I think they can play a large role in the skill coach. So a good example is, hey, well, if everybody's winning on striking, let me go back and take them down. Well, you may want to go against the trends, which is a good idea. If everybody's, you know, working at 10 minutes now, those are things that the conditioning coaches, performance coaches, strength coaches want to know. If they're winning the fights in that 18 to 14 second burst, well, let's make sure that they're good for 4 or 5 of those around. So good information in my eyes. And once again, it can be critiqued, but I would say this, and it is much better to have data that isn't perfect than continue to guess on non-existent data. So really fun stuff in my eyes.
Indeed. And all this this data, say, you were talking about, you know, how fighters win and having, you know, skills coaches kind of looking at all this data and, I guess, shaping their fighters' camps around those high percentage tactics and game plans. Do you foresee the game kind of shifting in the next few years as that information becomes more available to skills coaches who will actively shape their fighters' camps around those high percentage game plans?
Yeah, very well can, or to the point that you and I, so I know what happens like in, well, again, today in American sports, Mac, you know, what sells influences the way they want to push the, you know, the way they want to push the sport. So in American football, right, the New England Patriots score 40 points a game, that sells. So what are they going to do? They're going to make penalties on the defenders easier to ensure those points stay up. So let's just say that people want to see striking. It makes fights more exciting. What might the UFC do? Quicker stand-up times from the ground. Hey, this is boring. Yeah, you know, you're not controlling them. So we have a 30-second limit. You either show submission attempt, you show ground and pound, or we stand you back up. So my point to that is, Mac, I think that they, according to what may sell, they may shape the rules and the course of the fight accordingly, right? And that may have to be shaped with the athletic commissions, but that may be step one. So in better words, you may not be able to go against the grain. My thought is, if everybody's winning by striking, it's time for the wrestlers to throw people on their head again.
For sure.
Right? But you better do it quick is what I'm trying to say. Because if striking and the exciting stand-up fighter is what's selling, and that fighter is a striker like a Connor, who can handle himself on the ground, but people love his striking capacity, and the pay-per-view sales are up for the main event or the title fight because they know this guy throws 100 punches and 200 kicks around, obviously exaggerating, but then they're going to potentially shape the sport, the ruling bodies, to favor that. That's what's done in sport all the time. It's been done in Olympic hockey, in the National Hockey League here, in American baseball. So I think that my suggestion, obviously, would be let's cut against the grain. If everybody's standing up, they're preparing for stand-up fights, let's take them down, throw them on their head, and ground and pound again. Because everybody's been more competent once again in the stand-up. And they're sure the capacity to stuff to take down is greater, but you get somebody really good out there. Who's good, you know, can throw these guys down and take them to the ground, they're going to do it. So my opinion is it's going to be shaped, but I don't know necessarily just from that data. It'll be shaped probably on what sells, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And that's exactly what I was getting at. You know, the exciting fights sell, and that's kind of the way things are slowly but surely moving in a more commercial direction with all of this stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned earlier, just back to the UFC PI summit, was it a document called the cross-sectional analysis of a UFC fighter?
Yeah. Yes, and I can, that is the book that they produced with the different categories. They did some great work on nutrition and nutritional periodization, on how to optimize weight cut. I put together a little book on that with Phil DeRue, and I was happy.
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, thank you. And I was very happy to see that my data, without reviewing theirs, or not data, I mean, let's say conceptual markers. For example, Mac, you know, don't go 12% over body weight in the off season. Those were our estimates. They used the same ones, and I had not seen any of their information. But that book is available, and I'm sure they'll have no objection to that, and I will send that to you in a PDF.
I would be very grateful for that, my friend. That sounds terrific. I can't.
It's public information, and, you know, they're, again, to reiterate, commending UFCPI, they're not like, hey, this is ours. They're like, this is what we did for the fight world, and I really commend them for that.
Terrific. Yeah, that's really, really something. Now, I just want to kind of take a step backwards and just get to know you a little bit better, just so everyone listening can have a better understanding of who exactly you are, where you came from, what your background was like, and your journey through education to where you are today.
Okay. You know, it's always hard to speak of myself, but I'll do my best. I consider myself very, very lucky. I'm the, you know, son of two, I'm first generation here in the United States, Italian parents, and I grew up a commercial fisherman. And so I was lifting and pulling things and, you know, throwing things at a very young age. And of course, when you are on the docks, there's a propensity to fight all the time. That goes hand in hand with fishing. So that got me slightly interested in the fight sports. And I grew up, Mac, in a wonderful boxing era. So I'm 53 years of age now. And so I grew up, and I mean, I didn't, I remember Ali. I didn't, absorb his best years, but I certainly had the great middleweights of Hagler, Hearns, Leonard, Duran. So I was a tremendous boxing fan along with my father. And, you know, I started boxing at a young age, and I wasn't very good because I was always little and always weighed a lot and got spanked around. So I decided, you know what, I'm not just going to box. I'm going to learn how to throw people on their head, so because that would work for me better. So I went into judo and stuff like that, you know. And that's how I got an interest in love in the fight sports. Unfortunately, interscholastically, I couldn't participate much because we had a family business and I was always working. And that was the fishing business. And as a result of that, I didn't get to wrestle. I wanted to, and I did 1 year in my seventh grade year and was, you know, pretty good at it. But then it was back to work on the weekends, a couple weekdays, and I couldn't do sports. But I knew I loved it, so I stayed with, you know, all the martial arts and some judo and in recreational boxing. And then I decided at a very young age, wow, this is cool. I'm going to go to school and study this. And my first degree was in exercise phys, and you were pretty much laughed at in 1983 when I entered college for going to school for exercise physiology. I mean,
why is that?
Well, because there was no career other than physical education.
Right.
So I knew of a career, Mac, because I studied the Olympics. I watched, you know, the Cold War. I was inspired by watching America versus Russia in boxing, wrestling. And those were big sports in the 70s because you didn't have all these ancillary sports like you do now. There was more traditional Olympic sports. But outside of that, people didn't really go to school for sports science yet. There were barely any gyms around. They were either like what we would call a Jack LaLanne very fitness club or a hardcore bodybuilding gym or a boxing gym, you know? So many people didn't see any potential in that. So I went as ex-phys, really liked it, did some personal training, opened my own gym. Then after that, you know, kid, lost a little money, but always stayed involved in the fight sports. I was doing seminars for high school wrestling on conditioning and training when I was about 20 years of age. So I started a long time ago for my first formal intro into like helping fighters in fight sports, or if you want to call them combat sports, whichever you prefer. And then I just continued to go to school, opened a gym, did a lot of my own training, judo, jiu-jitsu, moved to Texas, where I had the fortune of training in a little gym called Trainers Elite. And that was nestled right in between Guy Mezga's gym and the great Carlos Machado's gym, and people would go back and forth, so I'd get to roll around with great jiu-jitsu people, learn from some great Pancration fighters, which of course was very popular at the time, and then always trained, started training some, you know, talking about 96, 97, some fighters as MMA is starting to come alive, continued to go to school, did a master's in nutrition, separate master's, again, in exercise phys, then a doctorate in health sciences, and now I'm doing a second doctorate in sports sci. So that's really the evolution, all while training myself. And I will tell you, pushing very hard. I would work with guys who did fight pro, did fight UFC, and I bang around with them. I just never had a desire to fight pro because I was always also so interested in academics, but I banged around with enough of the good guys to know what it's like. And then after moving back to Texas, a couple of people who were my friends here that I used to train with in fighting, I moved back here, got involved with a couple of kickboxers. Then the MMA guys up here got wind of that. And you know, before I knew it, I was doing some work out of Belmore Kickboxing. And then the Cerro Longo team asked me to come on. And that's where I am today and been with them for quite a few years and really love it. And I'm very, very fortunate to be involved in something I love so much, you know.
Fantastic. Now, you mentioned Guy Mezga, which a lot of hardcores will remember Guy Mezga as being part of Ken Shamrock's Lion's Den back in the day. Were they associated when you were working in between the Machado gym and Guy Mezga's gym?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they would call Guy's place kind of like Lion's Den South at the time. And he was very close with Ken. And by the way, in my opinion, to this day, one of the most underrated fighters of all time, Frank Shamrock,
Yeah,
that guy could do it all 20 years ago. Before anyone dreamed of doing it all, Frank could do it all. He can hit, he could kick, he could wrestle, and he had good jits. But so those guys would come out, And Guy was very close with them. And then I would go to some seminars and get to meet those guys and watch what they were doing. So it was really kind of cool. Like, that area of Dallas at the time was kind of called Lion's Den South, you know? And I was getting a real good feel, an introduction for the way the sport was going to go and who was going to help dictate its course just by training and working with those guys. So I was very fortunate to be in that location because it was kind of a hub at the time.
And it's almost prophetic in a way that you were so in such close proximity to guys like Frank Shamrock in the early days. And Frank, you know, these days people call him the godfather of modern mixed martial arts. It's, you know, that's kind of really, really special that you were in such close proximity in those early days to see how things could potentially shape up.
Yeah, that's right. And watching Frank is my point, to your point. The guy was good at everything before anyone knew anything, you know, and he was a very good multifaceted fighter for his time. And, you know, back then you were fighting guys, he'd fight Tito, who at that time the classes were much broader. As you know, I think Tito weighed 30, 40 pounds more than him.
Yeah.
So he was really good. And he was training out of California primarily, but he would come out to that part of the country several times a year and had the fortune of watching him work and philosophically how he approached that sport. And he was, you know, it was really fun to watch because, again, he in many ways was he forecasted it the way everything was going because that's what it turned out to be.
Yeah, the godfather, man. I like it. Yeah.
I like it. It's well earned.
Well, it's well earned by yourself as well. I mean, you know, Chris Algieri, Corey, and Phil DeRue, they've all called you the godfather of our industry, man. So, you know, a true testament to dedication and longevity in our industry, man. So I hope you take that as a compliment.
Well, I take that as a compliment. I take that as just those guys know that, you know, I will never make any claims to any major contributions or anything, but they do know that I love it. And I do think, you know, I stay up at night asking some relevant questions, Mac, on maybe how we could advance things more. That's all. And I'm going to have that opportunity to go to something really neat at UFCPI in September. And with Dr. Andy Galpin, who's running the National Strength and Conditioning Association clinic back out there. And so I'll speak on a subject with Dr. Galpin, had asked me to come up with something different. And that subject's going to be how to work with the single discipline fighter transitioning to MMA.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, so maybe it's less common now because you will have, you know, like here in America, we got young kids wrestling, and when they ain't wrestling, they're hitting mitts. And when they're not hitting mitts, they might be, you know, doing a little jiu-jitsu. So the sport is integrated. But as you know, Mac, hey, if somebody's a big name in boxing and they can sell pay-per-view, you know, somebody's going to transition them in. And so what we're going to look at here is the genetic predisposition, as an example. Why might someone gravitate toward boxing? What are the biomotor abilities that they may have naturally that make them good at boxing? What has changed in their body physiologically from boxing? At the periphery, in the brain, in their eyesight, in their vision, what window do they identify of attack? And so, you know, hey, they're probably going to be taller with narrow hips, light lower extremities, or they don't make good weight classes in boxing. So what do we do with that as an example, you know, with that hip structure, with that lean leg structure, with the inability to level change comfortably? And so how do we transition a potential just jiu-jitsu fighter to MMA, just a boxer to MMA, just the kickboxer like Wonder Boy, who's done a brilliant job and whom I love anyway, who's training jiu-jitsu, of course, with Carlos Machado. So